This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is Dean Hart, and I'm going to read to you some current articles from Newsweek magazine. This is from the news section. Kyle Rittenhouse shooting survivor wants revenge. He's a fraud. And this is by Ryan Smith. Man who survived being shot by Kyle Rittenhouse almost 4 years ago has branded him a fraud. And in an exclusive interview with Newsweek, Rittenhouse, now 21, came to the public attention in August 2020 at the age of 17, shot and killed two men, Joseph Rosenbaum, 36, Anthony Huber, 26, as well as injured then 26-year-old Paul Prediger at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So Rittenhouse said the three shootings carried out with a semi-automatic AR-15-style firearm was in self-defense. The Black Lives Matter BLM protest where the shooting took place was held after Jacob Blake, a black man, was left paralyzed from the waist down after he was shot by a white police officer. Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges in November 2021, including charges first-degree intentional homicide, attempted first-degree intentional homicide, first-degree reckless homicide, and two charges of first-degree recklessly endangering safety. Rittenhouse later said he supported the BLM movement, adding that he was at the demonstration to protect businesses and provide medical assistance. Prediger, who legally changed his name to Gage Grosskreutz following what he described as a post-trial harassment, told Newsweek in a telephone conversation that his life continues to be negatively impacted by the incident. "I've been, for lack of better term, pretty shitty," Prediger said of how things have panned out in the years after being shot in the bicep at the protest. Prediger, who was also armed, said he attempted to stop Rittenhouse from doing any further damage. He told Newsweek that he attended the protest to provide medical assistance. Following his name change in 2022, Prediger said he managed to live in relative anonymity until he was struck by a car in a hit-and-run in September of 2023 and his details became public knowledge. "I'm traumatized from it still," he shared of the shooting and the resulting public reaction to him, which he said largely fell down political lines. "I mean, I'm still working through PTSD, depression, anxiety, and being able to trust people and being comfortable in public, frankly. People recognize me still. I think I'm much more a man of many faces compared to Kyle Rittenhouse. He's pretty distinguishable. He's got the baby face and all that. I'm still in physical pain. I've learned to work through it, but I'm missing a portion of my arm." Newsweek contacted Rittenhouse via social media for comment on April 5th and was referred to his attorney. Newsweek contacted Rittenhouse's attorney via email April 5th and April 8th and April 12th, but had not received a response by the time of publication. If he responds, this article will be updated. Aftermath of the shooting. Given that many of his relatives support presumptive Republican 2024 presidential nominee Donald Trump, Prediger said he doesn't talk to pretty much anybody in my family anymore because of this. "I mean, obviously I still talk to my mom. She loves me. She supports me and believes in what I'm doing and believes that I'm right. But you know, there's like the physical and mental trauma, but all this shit that comes with it, it's hard to find a job. I've always got to double click what I'm doing or who I give my phone number out to, who I let know where I live, things like that, because all it takes is just one person to jeopardize your privacy." Prediger, who is now employed as a college instructor, said he would like to see Rittenhouse be held accountable. He has filed civil action for the shooting against Rittenhouse, with the case currently in the discovery stage. Rittenhouse says that he has PTSD, or he has trouble being out in public, in a public space. "I don't believe that because he's been out speaking since he was acquitted," Prediger said. Everybody processes PTSD differently. I'm not here trying to say that he wasn't affected by what he did. Unless you're just completely, some completely effective sociopath, you'll feel something for having to shoot and kill somebody. But I don't know. He had his right to do what he did, what he had to do, but I'm not believing that he was really negatively affected from this. I think Kyle Rittenhouse is the only person who came out on top in this situation. He should have been held accountable. I'm not just saying that to be biased because he shot me, but I digress. Second Amendment hero. Predator said that he has taken issue with Rittenhouse becoming something of a Second Amendment hero and influencer off the back of the shootings and the subsequent trial. Predator suggested that Rittenhouse is merely parodying the beliefs and thoughts of others. Objectively, I think he's an idiot, Predator said with a sigh. Unfortunately, he is like a poster boy. He is this young, gun-loving Republican who is going on these speaking tours with Turning Point USA founder and president Charlie Kirk. I think at the end of the day, he's a fraud in the sense of what does Kyle Rittenhouse even know about gun laws, apart from whatever the adults in his life told him. Whatever it is, his attorneys or fans or other politicians, I mean, I don't think the kid has an original thought at all and is parroting what he's been told. But that's because this is the only group, you know, right-wing extremist that will accept him. Rittenhouse has recently advertised a body armor kit named after him, documented the circumstances surrounding the 2020 shootings in his book, Acquitted. The book was released in November and has been described as a story of survival, resilience, and justice. I never wanted to be a public figure, a blurb for the book reads. I was homeless as a small child and raised in government-subsidized housing. My goal was to be a cop or a paramedic. I went to Kenosha and helped my community not become a whipping boy in the national debate. In less than 3 minutes, the direction of my life was horribly altered when I was forced to defend myself with deadly force. So much was said and written about me that was not true. Poster boy. Rittenhouse's rise, Predator told Newsweek, is pretty par for the course. I think he's a good poster boy. He's essentially lived out a fantasy that I feel like a lot of Americans probably have, where they get to justifiably defend themselves with force against rioters and protesters, especially given the climate of the country in 2020. I think it's definitely dangerous rhetoric, especially with our election coming up. You know, this is some ineffectual 21-year-old Predator said of Rittenhouse. He's a dumb kid. And then you have him going to the campuses about what? Nothing important. I've seen his little speeches that he does. Half of it is just him talking about, oh, I'm such a victim. I had to defend myself that night. That's not true. It's just not, you know, but the evidence that I'm finding has proven not to be not the case. Rittenhouse has embarked on a series of speaking engagements. Last month, he attracted headlines after departing the stage at the University of Memphis after some students confronted him about comments made by Turning Point USA's Kirk. When asked about a host of racist remarks that Kirk had made, Rittenhouse, who was invited to speak by the college's Turning Point USA chapter, told his jeering audience that he was not going to comment on that. In videos shared on social media, Rittenhouse was then abruptly seen exiting the stage, leading to claims that his departure was caused by the line of questioning. Rittenhouse denied this at the time, telling Newsweek in a statement, "The event was scheduled for 30 minutes. I spoke for 30 minutes. Then my security team told the coordinator that we were leaving. After the question and we left, I stayed for my scheduled time." Andrew Colvett, a spokesperson for Turning Point USA, said at the time Kyle didn't storm off. He waited to see if the protesters would allow him to speak. When it was apparent there was no hope of a constructive dialogue, he told the audience it would be his last question, then ended the Q&A and proceeded to address TPUSA students in a private room for about 2 hours, answering their questions and taking pictures. Dangerous agenda. I saw it, Predator told Newsweek of the video footage from the event. I mean, that just illustrates my point right there. He has no original thought. The kid can't debate, obviously. He can't even handle simple Q&A. And I think when he is confronted with the reality of the situation, he runs away. He runs back to those people that will coddle him and stroke his ego. Oh no, they're just a bunch of liars, BLM protesters. They don't know what they're talking about. I mean, he's a child. Does Predator at least believe that Rittenhouse deserves a platform to serve an audience whose views align? No, absolutely not, Predator responded. I mean, he brings nothing of value to any discussion. I'm not saying I'm anti-Second Amendment or any of that. I'm just saying, what does Rittenhouse have to add to the conversation about gun control? What, because he shot a few people? I think it's just dangerous to put somebody at the forefront who really doesn't know what they're talking about. He has no real world experience, apart from that night. And that doesn't make you an expert for talking about gun control. But people who do know what they're talking about and do have an agenda to push, they understand that Rittenhouse will get the clicks, get the views, get the money going in or coming in. But I do not believe for 1 second that anybody takes him seriously. Predator said that if he and Rittenhouse ever came face-to-face, he'd likely greet him with a solid F you. Had you asked me this question 2 years ago, my response would have been a lot more sympathetic, but no. Anything I need to say to him, I'll say it at the civil trial. And I don't mean like in a childish, petty kind of way, but there's nothing that I need to say to him personally. It's just my goal to take him down on this trial and show the world what he is, and I think that'll speak enough within itself. This one is from the business section of the magazine. Women are working longer hours from home than men, by Suzanne Blake. While remote work might be preferred by a large portion of the workforce in the post-pandemic world, the numbers don't reflect the same working habits for men and women. When working from home full-time, 48% of women said they were working longer hours, compared to just 43% of men, according to a new Flex Jobs report. Meanwhile, 42% of women said they worked the same amount as when working full-time in office, and a higher percentage of men, 47%, said the same. Only 10% of both men and women said they worked shorter hours than when they were in the office. The higher number of hours worked from home for women might be surprising, when women on average were far more likely to prefer a 100% remote job. In the report, 73% of women said that was their preferred work format, while only 63% of men did, despite often working the same number of hours or fewer. Allison Stevens, Senior Director of HR Services at Payroll and HR Solutions Company Paychex, said the longer hours likely occur as women are balancing more household responsibilities beyond the workplace, like childcare and taking care of elder family members. That could also be why women had a stronger preference for remote work, while men were more likely to prefer being in the office. Having the ability to work remotely allows a family's primary caretaker to do all the things versus having to also coordinate their lives with the added complexity of commute times, Stevens told Newsweek. Megan Pirochakos, the Senior Director of DEI and Membership Relationship Advisor at Seramount, echoed the sentiment, saying, women, despite working full-time, often still satisfy the role of a primary caregiver for their children. Remote work offers women an opportunity for flexible work arrangements that allows them to spend more time at home, enabling them to manage those responsibilities as well, Pirochakis told Newsweek. The problem arises when companies look only to their in-person staff for promotions, she said. Companies that have adopted hybrid RTO structures should make sure that they aren't only rewarding those in the office with promotions, overlooking women in the process, Pirochakos said. Jen Mahone Reitler, the founder of the diversity and inclusion firm Elements to Inclusion, said the gap between the hours worked could show a larger issue in how companies are approaching their remote and hybrid work situations. It also says that we are not looking at the bigger picture for what our female talent can truly do for our corporations if given the tools and resources to be truly flexible, Mahone Reitler told Newsweek. Again, we have shown during COVID that we are more productive while working remotely, yet we don't want to find viable, flexible solutions to make it work and are willing to risk losing top talent. Since women have proved they can manage households, get the kids to school on time, and work full-time at a top-performing level, remote work seems the ideal option for many, and companies are starting to realize it, Mahone Reitler said. Why would they need to be in the office every day? Mahone Reitler said, success and this new work environment looks differently, and we need to manage it differently. I just wish we would be more open to understanding the evolution of what real change requires and stop reverting back to old school methodologies that no longer suit the vast majority of our populations. Christine C. Durst, co-founder of the remote work platform RatRaceRebellion.com, said women surveyed by the company in managerial roles also reported logging longer hours than their male counterparts. Durst said it often came down to concerns that they might be overlooked for promotions or raises because they were not physically present. They are often compelled to stack more work on to today in hopes that tomorrow will be easier, only to find that tomorrow is always super busy, Durst told Newsweek. Societal expectations also push women to prove themselves more within a professional setting, said Allie Nathaniel, owner of Slow Staffing Solutions. This can lead to women feeling compelled to take on additional responsibilities and placing greater pressure on themselves to perform well, while men may be more likely to attribute failure to external factors, Nathaniel told Newsweek, adding that this extends to other minority groups in the workforce as well. While it may appear that women have made significant strides, the reality often tells a different story. Despite venturing into jobs outside the home, women continue to shoulder the majority of household responsibilities. This dual burden frequently leads to feelings of overload and eventual burnout. Women who continue to face relatively unchanged workforces built around masculine norms and dynamics, she said, especially for women, particularly those in the stage of bearing and raising children, the fear of potential job loss can be a significant motivator to go above and beyond to secure their employment, Nathaniel said. This often translates to putting in extra hours while still needing the flexibility to manage familial responsibilities. According to Paychex's small business data, the hourly earnings gender gap for women still stands at 81 cents for every dollar earned by men. The ultimate goal is to achieve a more equitable distribution of household burdens between men and women, Nathaniel said. She added, hopefully, as societal norms continue to evolve, we'll see progress toward this shared responsibility and a more balanced approach to work-life dynamics. This article comes under the sports heading. O.J. Simpson's death draws reactions from around the sports world. And this is by John Paul Hornstra. O.J. Simpson was trying to call Bob Costas. It was June 17th, 1994, and Simpson was the most famous passenger in a white Ford Bronco leading a police and helicopter chase around the Los Angeles freeway. Simpson had a phone in his car, and he needed a favor from Costas. Getting through was a challenge in the pre-cell phone world, as Costas explained in an interview with CNN on Thursday when Simpson died of cancer. Eventually, he called the studio where we did the NFL show from, which was also where we did the NBA show from. But on this occasion, since it was the finals, we were at Madison Square Garden, Costas told CNN's Boris Sanchez. The phone rang and rang and rang. Apparently, he tried it a few times, and an engineer eventually answered the phone. He said, "I need to speak to Bob Costas." "Who's calling?" "O.J. Simpson." "Yeah, right. Click." He hung up. Days later, Costas said he was able to speak to Simpson, former Buffalo Bills teammate Al Cowlings, and attorney Robert Kardashian in a Los Angeles County jail. The Broncos driver Cowlings told Costas that they had called during the fateful freeway chase. "I was being defamed, not so much about the alleged murder, but my whole life was being defamed. And I thought you could give a different viewpoint as my friend," Costas recalled. Simpson saying, "I didn't bother to explain to him what the journalistic imperatives would have been at the time." Asked what he would have asked Simpson at the moment, Costas said, "The first thing you'd have to ask Boris, as I delicately but still directly as possible, is, O.J., did you do it?" The simple question, whether or not Simpson was responsible for murdering Nicole Brown, Simpson, and Ron Goldman on June 12, 1994, dominated the legacy of the former football star until the end of his life. Even those in the sports world who were alive during Simpson's heyday, when the Buffalo Bills, that's when the Buffalo Bills were clearly troubled by the question Thursday. Former Los Angeles Lakers star Magic Johnson, retired Major League Baseball slugger Jose Canseco, and former NFL quarterback Robert Griffin III were among those who commented on Simpson's death on Thursday. NFL Hall of Fame running back O.J. Simpson has died at the age of 76 after a battle with cancer, was the entirety of Griffin's post on Threads. Canseco wrote on his Twitter X account, "O.J. Simpson was a murderer. His death should not be glorified." Philadelphia Eagles cornerback Darius Slay wrote a more conventional tribute to Simpson on Thursday. Magic Johnson also took to Twitter X to write, "Cookie and I are praying for O.J. Simpson's children, and now Aaron, Justin, Jason, and Sydney, and his grandchildren following his passing. I know this is a difficult time." This one's from the U.S. section of the magazine, "Donald Trump's hush money case extremely difficult for prosecution lawyer. The Stormy Daniels hush money case against Donald Trump is very weak and an extremely difficult case for the prosecution to win," according to one legal expert. Speaking to Newsweek, Trey Lavelle, a Los Angeles-based corporate law attorney, said the case reeks of a desperate attempt to go after Trump, who has a very reasonable alibi. Trump has been charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records, which prosecutors claim he did to cover up the payment of $130,000 in hush money to Stormy Daniels, a former pornographic actress ahead of the 2016 presidential election. The former president has pled not guilty to all charges and denies having sexual relations with Daniels, which she claims took place in 2006. Trump, the presumptive 2024 GOP presidential nominee, is set on Monday to become the first former president in the history of the United States to stand trial in a criminal case. Falsification of business records is typically a misdemeanor under New York law, but can count as a felony. It can count as felonies if done to cover up another crime, as Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is alleging in the Trump case. The alleged payments were facilitated by Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, who in 2018 pled guilty to 8 counts of breaking campaign finance and other laws with the aim of impacting the 2016 presidential race. Lavelle commented, the hush money case against Trump is very weak and full of reasonable doubt. It reeks of a desperate attempt to go after Trump by connecting a few dots. Trump has strong defense arguments to rely on, making this an extremely difficult case for the prosecution to win. Trump has a very reasonable alibi motive. Hiding the payment was for personal reasons to save his marriage and protect his family, had nothing to do with the election. The lawyer also suggested the impact of Daniels' claim that had it gone public, would have been limited compared to the publication of an Access Hollywood tape on October 7th of 2016, which Trump was heard saying, "You can do anything with women when you're a star," before adding, "Grab them by the puss." Lavelle argued hiding the affair following the leak of the Access Hollywood tape, which was much more damaging to comparison. Any affair Trump might have had would pale in comparison to the political fallout from his demeaning characterization of women on the Access Hollywood tape. This supports the argument that his reasons for the payment were personal and not related to his presidential campaign, because if it would have no effect on the election, at the very least, it amounts to reasonable doubt and that equals acquittal. Newsweek contacted Trump representatives by email in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, by telephone and voicemail message outside of the usual business hours on Saturday. This article will be updated if either wishes to comment. In an interview with Newsweek, Robert Swofford, a legal expert and founder of Strike for Cause Jury Consultants, said one Trump supporter on the jury could prevent a guilty verdict, as this would require unanimity. He said if one true believer, a MAGA supporter, manages to get on the jury, then it won't matter how much evidence the prosecution brings to bear. That juror will sit there until kingdom come and say not guilty, and the juror will derail the case because the verdict must be unanimous in a criminal trial. I'm sure that both legal teams are doing research on the prospective jurors' social media accounts, their voting records, any prior criminal convictions and credit histories. Everything that can be searched in a database. But at the end of the day, if someone scrubbed their social media or their activity on internet forums, those online trails become very hard to find. Trump is also facing criminal trials over accusations he mishandled classified documents, then obstructed their return to the relevant authorities, and broke the law attempting to overthrow the 2020 presidential election, both across the nation and in the state of Georgia specifically. He has pled not guilty to all charges and insists the cases against him are politically motivated. My name is Dean Hart, and I read to you some current articles from Newsweek magazine.